Welcome to the Deep Dive. We take complex topics, dig in, and pull out the key insights for you. Today, we're exploring something that feels, well, increasingly necessary for a lot of people. The idea of having a plan B.
That's right. We've been looking at some really interesting material from Mikkel Thorup, an international consultant. He talks about building an economic backup plan. He calls it political insurance, actually, for yourself, your family, your money, your assets. The whole package.
Yeah, it's less about, you know, stockpiling food and more about smart financial and legal moves, making sure you have a safe place to go and the ability to get there quickly if things go sideways.
Exactly. So our job today is to really unpack his framework. He calls it the 4+1 framework for setting up this plan B. We'll look at the threats he sees and the sort of pillars you need to build internationally.
Okay, let's get into it. Why now? Why does Mikkel Thorup think this kind of economic plan B is so critical in what he calls a world gone mad? What's pushing people towards this?
Well, he sees a few major things converging, both globally and, you know, domestically. First off, political instability and social unrest. He talks about this giant left-right divide that's apparently even split families apart. Just widespread division, tension around elections.
Yeah.
People basically looking for somewhere they can just tune out the constant political noise.
And it's not just political, right? He has some pretty serious economic warnings, too.
Oh, absolutely. He warns about potential financial collapse, points to these massive bubbles, housing, debt, mortgages. And he notes that bank failures in 2023 were the highest since the Great Depression. That's pretty stark.
Wow.
Yeah. And he mentions, you know, billions upon billions upon billions of dollars flowing out of these countries. He sees that as a huge red flag. Loss of confidence in the old systems.
And government actions play a role, too, according to him.
Yes, definitely. That's a big piece of it. He talks about the strangulation of businesses with bureaucracy, especially after COVID, making it harder for entrepreneurs. Then you've got government war and geopolitical conflicts, ongoing money printing and inflation.
Right.
Plus things like forced health mandates, mandatory vaccinations, he mentions, and the whole lockdowns and closures of business thing. And lastly, he even brings up cultural factors, like what he terms this disgusting woke cancel culture as another reason people are looking for an exit ramp, so to speak.
Okay, so it's a combination of factors all pushing in the same direction. The idea is to build this political insurance as a shield against these growing threats.
That sums it up pretty well.
Yeah.
It's about resilience in uncertain times.
That definitely lays out the why. It makes sense why people feel they need this kind of insurance. But okay, knowing why is one thing. How do you actually build it? Let's dig into Mikkel's framework, starting with pillar one. Immigration. Freedom of movement. What does that look like in practice?
Right. So it starts with permanent residency, or PR. That's basically a long-term visa, lets you live and work in another country, and you get most of the rights citizens have. But the key difference from, say, a temporary work visa is that PR can lead to citizenship through naturalization.
And citizenship is the ultimate goal here.
For Thorup, yes. He calls it the ultimate option. Full rights, voting, everything. And crucially, you can pass it down to your kids, your grandkids. He sees that as a massive gift for future generations.
Okay, and the passport is obviously central to all this, the driver's license analogy you mentioned earlier.
It really is. Having a second passport, or even a third, dramatically increases your visa-free travel. More countries you can just hop on a plane and go to, no visa hassle beforehand. It's huge for flexibility.
Yeah, just instant access.
Exactly. Plus, it's a backup if your main passport gets lost, stolen, or tied up in a visa application. And sometimes it can open doors to specific investments or let you settle in whole regions like Europe's Schengen area. It just gives you way more options.
Definitely expands the playing field. So the $1 million question, or maybe the $250,000 question, based on what you said earlier, how do you actually get one of these second passports? Legally, of course.
Right. Absolutely legally. He talks about whitelisted strategies. These are the legitimate above board ways. First is ancestry. If your parents, grandparents came from certain places, Italy, Spain, Portugal, are common examples you might qualify just based on your lineage.
Okay, digging into the family tree.
Exactly. Second, birthright. Just being born in certain countries, Canada, the U.S., Chile, Brazil, automatically makes you a citizen there.
Simple enough if you qualify.
Then there's citizenship by investment, or CBI. This is where you make a significant financial contribution, often a donation, to a country's government fund. Several Caribbean nations do this, St. Kitts, Antigua, St. Lucia, Dominica, Grenada. He mentions around $250,000 for a family of four as a typical ballpark figure. It's usually the quickest path.
So you can essentially buy citizenship in some places?
Legally, yes. Then there's naturalization. This is the more common path, living in a country for a set number of years, meeting requirements like language tests, maybe history exams. Thorpe calls this the free way compared to CBI, but it takes time and effort. He's doing this himself in Panama, 5+ years, learning Spanish, studying the history.
So more of a long-term commitment.
Definitely. And then there are rarer ways. Exception, maybe for huge contributions to science or culture, religion, like Israel's right of return for Jewish people, and marriage to a foreign national.
Got it. And the key takeaway seems to be stick to these known legal whitelisted routes. Avoid the shady gray zone stuff or the downright illegal black zone fake documents.
Absolutely critical. The whole point is security and freedom. You don't get that with dodgy documents.
Makes sense. Okay, so you've got the ability to move. Pillar two is about the money, international investments, making sure your capital can move freely too, right?
Precisely. It's about being able to move money in and out of countries without getting hit by crazy taxes, or worse, getting blocked by controls. So key tools here are things like offshore bank accounts.
Okay, what defines offshore here?
Simply an account in a country where you're not resident. Think traditional places like Switzerland, maybe Andorra, or hubs like Singapore, Hong Kong. Thorpe really stresses looking for fee-based banks, not commission-based, and critically checking their capitalization rates.
Capitalization rates? What's that?
It's basically how much of the bank's own money is backing its operations compared to depositors' money. He gives an example. A Panama bank at 29% versus maybe 2-4% for typical U.S. or Canadian banks. That higher rate means the bank is way more stable, much less likely to fail if there's a crisis. It's a measure of solvency.
Ah, okay, so a bigger safety cushion. What else?
International brokerage accounts to trade stocks globally, access different products. Precious metals accounts for holding physical gold and silver offshore. And here, the magic words are 100% allocated, 100% segregated, and 100% insured.
Break that down. What does that actually guarantee?
It means you own specific, identifiable bars or coins allocated. They're stored separately from the institution's own assets, segregated, and they're fully insured against loss or theft. It's direct ownership, not just a paper claim.
Got it. Direct physical ownership stored securely elsewhere.
Exactly. He also mentions things like crypto accounts, merchant accounts if you run an online business, and diversifying your actual cash holdings into multiple strong currencies, Swiss francs, British pounds, Singapore dollars, maybe.
Now, you mentioned controls earlier. Thorpe warns about capital controls specifically. How real is that threat?
He sees it as already happening at a low level, what he calls shadow level controls. Mm-hmm. He mentions Canada, potentially the U.S., where banks might start questioning large transfers, delaying them, making it harder to get your money out. So the big question becomes, if you need to access your capital fast in an emergency, can you actually get it? Having assets outside your home country mitigates that risk.
Which leads directly to another physical piece of this pillar, the second home, the landing pad.
That's it. Your physical safe haven. He's got criteria for this, too.
Hmm.
Should be reasonably priced. He uses the example of beachfront places in Brazil for maybe $100,000. Crucially, it needs freehold title. That means you own the land and building outright. No leases, full control.
No ground rent or anything like that.
Right. It should also have the potential to generate cash flow, rent it out when you're not using it.
Hmm.
Needs to be in a desirable area so it's liquid, easy to sell if needed. On-site management helps with rentals. And obviously, it has to be in a politically and economically stable country with a stable currency.
And he has this really interesting focus on the country's independence, not just its stability.
Yes, this is a point he really hammers home. The importance of choosing a country that is food, water, and energy independent. His example is Uruguay. Small population, maybe 3.5 million, but produces food for 40 million.
Wow.
That kind of self-sufficiency makes the government much less vulnerable to pressure from, say, big international organizations or other powerful countries. They can't easily be squeezed. It creates a more robust sanctuary. And for financing that second home, he advises paying cash or using minimal developer financing just to avoid getting caught underwater if property markets take a dive.
Okay, pillar three, wealth protection. Once you have these international assets, how do you legally shield them?
This gets into legal structures. Beyond standard business structures like LLCs or IBCs, international business companies, he draws a really important distinction for personal wealth protection between trusts and foundations.
What's the difference there? They sound similar.
They achieve similar goals but operate differently based on legal systems. A trust is typically a common law thing. Think US, Canada, UK. It's basically a legal agreement where a grantor gives assets to a trustee to manage for a beneficiary. It's a fiduciary responsibility contract, but the trust itself isn't usually its own separate legal entity.
Okay, it's an arrangement.
Exactly. A foundation, however, comes from civil law systems common in Europe, Latin America.
Yeah.
It's more like a hybrid of a trust and a corporation. It is its own legal entity, a juridical person with its own tax ID. It can own assets directly, have its own bank accounts. It offers, in many ways, a stronger separation and potentially more control for the founder.
So the foundation is like its own legal person holding the assets. What are the main advantages of setting up these kinds of admittedly complex structures?
Several key benefits. First, liability protection. It walls off assets. If your business gets sued, assets in the trust or foundation might be protected. If you get sued personally, the assets held by the structure are separate. Second, privacy and anonymity. Your name isn't necessarily on the public record as the owner of the asset.
It keeps things low profile.
Third, estate planning. These structures can often bypass probate court, making inheritance smoother, faster, and private. Fourth, tax optimization, which ties into the next pillar. And fifth, legacy planning. These structures can often exist indefinitely, allowing wealth to be managed and passed down for generations without rules against perpetuity that sometimes apply to simpler wills.
Sounds powerful. What are the downsides?
Well, they're not simple. There's compliance, more paperwork, potentially filings in both your home country and the structure's jurisdiction. And there's setup costs involved to get lawyers and professionals to draft everything correctly. It's an investment in protection.
Okay, that leads smoothly into pillar four, legal tax mitigation. Crucially, legal mitigation, not evasion.
Absolutely. He is extremely clear on this.
Yeah.
Only use whitelisted strategies. Everything must be legal, transparent, and defensible. No gray areas, definitely no black zone illegal stuff. He insists on using qualified, licensed professionals, lawyers, accountants who will actually sign off on the advice and structuring. And it has to be tailored to your specific goals. No one size fits all.
And this is where that unique U.S. tax system really comes into play again, isn't it?
It really does. As we touched on, the U.S. has citizenship-based taxation. Doesn't matter where you live. If you're a U.S. citizen, you owe U.S. tax on your worldwide income. Only Eritrea does the same thing. It's very unusual.
Compared to
a territorial tax system, which is the norm in many, many countries. Panama is a prime example he uses. In a territorial system, you only pay tax on income earned inside that country. Money you earn from foreign sources, say, from online work for clients outside Panama, or investment income from outside Panama, is simply not taxed by Panama.
Okay, that's a huge difference. So for an American moving abroad, maybe to Panama, what does this mean practically? They still have to file U.S. taxes, right?
Yes, U.S. citizens always have to file with the IRS. But there's a major tool called the Foreign Earned Income Exclusion, the FEIE. For 2024, it lets you exclude about $126,500 of earned income salary, self-employment income from U.S. taxation.
Wow.
And if you're married and both spouses qualify, you can potentially double that exclusion. So imagine living in Panama. You pay zero Panamanian tax on your foreign earnings and potentially zero U.S. tax on the first $126,500, even $253,000 per couple. It makes international living incredibly tax efficient if structured correctly.
That's a very powerful incentive. Okay, so we've covered the four main pillars: movement, money, protection, taxes. But there's the fault plus one. Lifestyle. This seems crucial for making the whole thing work long term.
It really is the glue that holds it together. Because what good is a perfect plan B on paper if you hate living there? This pillar is all about matching the place to you. So things to consider are ease of access. Can you get in and out easily? Flights, connections.
Practical stuff.
Very practical. Cost of living. Can you live better for less? Often it's 30-50% cheaper than, say, the U.S. or Canada. Healthcare. Is it good quality? Is it affordable? He tells a story about his own family in Panama. Four people, five emergency room visits at a top private hospital. Total cost around $1,100. That's unthinkable in the U.S.
Yeah, that's dramatically different.
Then there's the legal system. Common law, like the U.S. or civil law, affects contracts, property rights, time zone and climate, purely personal preference. Do you want tropical heat or four seasons? Activities, does it offer things you enjoy doing?
Surfing, hiking, city life.
Exactly. Value systems. This is a big one he mentions. Many clients are actively seeking cultures they perceive as more traditional, more family-oriented, maybe less influenced by what they call woke ideology, language. Mm-hmm. How easy is it to learn? He suggests tools like storylearningcourses.com, schooling for kids, quality local schools, international schools, homeschooling networks.
Right, critical for families.
Absolutely. Infrastructure, good roads, reliable internet, safety, low crime rates. And again, that point about food, water, and energy stability. He keeps coming back to self-sufficient nations being more resilient. Plus, understanding your rights as a foreigner and the overall political stability, it's a comprehensive checklist for quality of life.
That focus on family values in schooling really highlights how this isn't just for, you know, single C-suite executives. It's often families looking for a different environment for their kids.
Definitely. He says a large portion of his clients are families. And the service goes beyond just the legal and financial development. It includes help with integrating, finding schools, seeing the move itself as a positive life experience, and a gift to the children's development.
Okay, so we've got this detailed framework. Someone listening is thinking, wow, this makes sense. I need to look into this. What's the next step? How do you actually implement this kind of plan B?
Well, Mikkel lays out two basic paths. Path one is do it yourself. That's what he did. But he says it took him like 25 years of research, travel, making mistakes, learning the hard way. It's possible, but it's a massive undertaking.
Yeah, a quarter century is a long time.
Right. Path two is working with professionals, like his consultancy, Expat Money. They've built networks of vetted lawyers, accountants, real estate people in over 20 countries. They offer different levels of service from like information products for DIRs who want a roadmap up to full one-on-one consulting where they basically handle the strategy and implementation. He says they focus on working with cool, interesting people who are action-oriented, basically people serious about making it happen and want to save themselves years of hassle and potential pitfalls.
Okay. And you mentioned specific countries earlier. Based on the source material, can you give us a few highlights or contrasts that often come up?
Sure. Panama comes up a lot as a top choice.
Yeah.
Reasons being, great infrastructure in the city, very safe, high-quality healthcare. They even have a Johns Hopkins-affiliated hospital, great climate, huge travel hub. And that territorial tax system, fueled by the canal, is a massive economic driver and attractor.
And the canal provides a sort of stability guarantee.
That's his point. Its global importance means major powers like the U.S. and China have a vested interest in keeping Panama stable and functioning. It's strategic. And while there's an old law in the books about dual citizenship, he says it's basically not enforced and being challenged, so it's effectively a non-issue for most.
Okay, Panama sounds like a strong contender. What about somewhere like Mexico? Lots of Americans go there.
Mexico's great for like a lifestyle play, or what he calls a playground flag. Amazing food, people, culture, beaches. But that high 35% marginal tax rate makes it pretty unattractive if your goal is tax residency as part of the plan B. Better for visits or maybe just owning property.
Right. How about El Salvador? Big changes there recently.
Yeah, he's super bullish on El Salvador. Praises the amazing changes, the Bitcoin adoption, the incredible turnaround on crime, making it maybe the safest country in the Americas now. He really likes the government's direction. But he adds the caveat that it still needs more development to really attract major foreign investment and be a fully rounded Plan B hub. Promising, but maybe still early days for some.
And Argentina? Similar situation with a new direction.
Very similar sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
Super bullish on President Milei's free market reforms, but advises a wait-and-see approach for actually relocating significant assets or high-net-worth clients. Needs time to stabilize.
Any countries he specifically advises against for a plan B?
He mentions Peru. Beautiful country for a holiday, but he sees it as very collectivistic. Uses an example of them having a two-mask rule long after COVID and leaning socialist, so generally not recommended for this purpose. Costa Rica, popular for ecotourism, but he cites poor infrastructure, outside tourist zones, and some controversial mandatory child vaccination policies as negatives compared to, say, Panama.
Interesting. And what about Asia? Japan, for instance.
Japan, he says, is nearly impossible for foreigners to get citizenship or even long-term residency unless they have Japanese heritage. And critically, Japan does not allow dual nationality. You'd have to renounce your original citizenship. That's usually a non-starter for a plan B.
Okay, that makes sense. One last practical question that probably affects a lot of American listeners. What happens to your Social Security or Medicare if you move abroad?
Generally, becoming an expat doesn't affect your eligibility for Social Security benefits you've earned. Medicare is a bit trickier as it generally doesn't cover care outside the U.S., but your eligibility remains if you return. And while some international health plans might cover brief trips back home, say for 30 days, most people rely on specific travel insurance or medical evacuation insurance for emergencies if they need care back in the U.S.
Good to know. So this deep dive really gives a clear, structured way to think about building resilience in, well, what feels like a pretty unpredictable world. It's about peace of mind, protecting what you've built, and securing the lifestyle you want, regardless of what happens politically or economically.
Exactly. And maybe the final thought to leave people with is this. Is 2025 the year you start taking this seriously? The trends. Mikkel highlights the instability, the economic pressures, the government overreach. They seem to be accelerating. He puts it starkly. They have made it abundantly clear that they're coming for everything that you have worked so hard for. So the question is, will you take steps to protect what's yours?
A powerful caution indeed. If you're interested in learning more about Micklethorpe's approach and services, you can find details at expatmoney.com/woods. We'll put that link in the show notes. For general questions, the email is support@expatmoney.com. Thanks for diving deep with us today.